Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what are the different types of schools in Israel, and how is religion taught in them? Dr. Asher Maoz is the dean of the Perez Academic Center Law School in Rehovot, Israel. He's also professor of law at Tel Aviv University, where he teaches constitutional law, family law, state, and religion. He's editor-in-chief of Law, Society, and Culture, and a member of the board of the International Scientific and Professional Advisory Council of the United Nations Crime Prevention and Criminal Justice Program. Professor Maoz is a fellow of the Whitney R. Harris Institute for Global Legal Studies at Washington University, St. Louis, and has been co-chair of the Joint Working Group on Freedom of Religion, Multiculturalism, and the Rights of Minorities of the Canada-Israel Legal Cooperation Program. Dr. Maoz has participated in scores of conferences and symposiums and is the author of dozens of publications with an emphasis on human rights and freedoms. Together with Antoine Nasri Massara of Lebanon and William Warda of Iraq, Professor Maoz was in Madrid recently to present a report on religious freedom in the Middle East, study on the Lebanese, Israeli, and Iraqi model. This report was the result of a study done by the Centro de Estudios de Oriente Medio, Center of Middle Eastern Studies, a multidisciplinary think tank which is part of the Spanish NGO Fundación Promoción Social de la Cultura, Foundation for the Social Promotion of Culture, a private, non-profit organization that works in favor of human development and the promotion of culture. Dr. Maoz spoke with us about the report and also about religious and other freedoms in Israel.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today. First, I would like to speak with you a little bit about your own background. You're a law professor, and it seems that your emphasis has always been in the area of human rights and different kinds of freedoms, academic freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. I serve as dean of the Perez Academic Center Law School, and my main areas are really constitutional law. In that part, I am involved very much in freedoms, rights and freedoms, and specifically in the area of religion and law, and some other areas like family law, which in Israel is very connected to religion.
When you say constitutional law, Israel really doesn't have a constitution, does it?
Well, I think it does have a partial constitution, an incomplete constitution. Although the president of the state, I don't think it's still his view, but a speaker of the Knesset expressed the view that Israel has no constitution. What happened was that when Israel was declared, a constituent assembly was elected with the task of drafting a constitution for the state. It dissolved without giving a constitution and transferring the constituent power to the Knesset, which is Israel's parliament. So since then, Israel's parliament is both a legislature and a constituent assembly. What the Knesset did since, it enacted some 13 what they call basic laws, which eventually will compose the complete Israeli constitution. And we got stuck, by the way, in two matters. One is the issue of judicial review, which is very much in conflict in Israel. The second is the area of human rights. The Knesset enacted two basic laws in the area of human rights, but it's a sensitive area in Israel due to the issue of religion and law.
You're also the co-chair of the Joint Working Group on Freedom of Religion, Multiculturalism, and the Rights of Minorities of the Canada-Israel Legal Cooperation Program. Can you tell us a little bit about what that program is?
I admit that is true, but we didn't do anything for many years. There was a time when I was involved very much with the Canadian Supreme Court and with Canadian professors. Actually, Erwin Kotler, who was the former Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, he established this program, but for quite a few years it doesn't work. Maybe he'll now finish his time at Parliament, maybe he'll have more time and will revive it. It started with a huge conference which we made to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the State of Israel and of the Declaration of Human Rights, Universal Declaration, and that's when we started it. And by the way, as a matter of, we had three members, two professors, and a district court judge who participated in that conference. Were elevated within a year or so to the Supreme Court of Canada when I visited them with the members of the Constitutional Committee of the Knesset. They said, well, whoever wants to be elevated to the Supreme Court should participate in a conference that you organize. So that's just a matter. It's half a joke.
Okay. I've read several of your articles in Haaretz, of course, in English, and it seems that you counterpose certain concepts that I think are very interesting. For example, in one you wrote about academic freedom as opposed to freedom of speech, and this was with reference to the boycott of Israel.
Yeah, I wouldn't say as opposed to freedom of speech. What I said is that first of all, freedom of speech is granted, in my view, to everyone, whether he's academic or not. He can be academic, he can be any worker. What I do oppose is the use of academic freedom for non-academic purposes, as a matter of fact, in order to combat freedom of speech. There are professors in Israel that use their academic freedom in order to preach for some political views, and I don't mind whether they are left or right, and imposing them on the students. If I would take, I don't know if you read that article, there was a professor in Jerusalem who told his class that he is very tough on participating in the lectures. However, he will release from that duty anyone who will go to the check posts between the West Bank and Israel to demonstrate against what he called occupation. On the other hand, he won't excuse students who are drafted for Miluim, which is the reserve duty. They have no choice. They must go there. But he won't regard it as an excuse for not participating in a class. And this, I think, is something that is against academic freedom and against freedom of speech. And the second thing, I don't know, we have another issue in Israel of professors of my university, or my former university. I'm still working there partially, Tel Aviv University or other universities, that call for an academic boycott on Israel and on their universities as well. This I can never understand, how a person can work at the Tel Aviv University or at the Hebrew University and propagate for banning their institution. This is something I could never understand. I cannot understand academic boycott whatsoever, because academia is based on the flow of opinions and what have you, and views. And I don't see any room for boycott in that area. But the issue or the phenomenon of a person calling for boycotting his own institution who pays his salary, this seems to me something that I think it's an Israeli invention. I never I never met it anywhere in the world.
Although there have been movements on different university campuses in other countries, in the United States, certainly, that...
You mean boycotting Israel?
We're trying to, yes, to boycott Israel.
Okay,
yeah.
I think it's very much non-academic to boycott a university anywhere.
Yeah.
But on top of that, what I cannot understand at all is a person who calls to boycott his own university. Mm-hmm. If he has something against Tel Aviv University or the Hebrew University, let him resign and either fight from within. And we have different views in the university. We have a few thousand professors, and not all of us share the same views. But to be in the university, to work for the university, and there was a few conferences, academic conferences in Israel, in universities, calling for boycotting that university. This is something the logic of which I cannot understand. Maybe I have some defect in understanding things, but I just can't understand it. Mm-hmm. As I said, I'm against any boycott, any academic boycott. I'm against academic boycott, but I certainly cannot understand a person who calls to boycott his own institution when he wants.
Something else you've written about is the issue of human rights versus security.
Yes. This is actually the issue, the most interesting and the hardest issue that we experience in Israel because of the security issue. And I don't know any other country in the world where you have so much individual freedom in such problematic security issues. I sent two articles of mine to a former justice of the Supreme Court, Wedderburn, and he wrote to me back, and this is something perhaps that should be known. He said, more or less, we play with freedoms, but we should come to the Supreme Court of Israel to learn what exactly it means to fight for freedoms when you are under security attacks. So still, I'm of the view that we shouldn't give up to security, but certainly freedom and human rights are not a prescription for committing suicide, as the Supreme Court of Israel once said. But I think the Supreme Court goes as far as possible and more so in fighting for freedoms in view of security threats that Israel suffers.
Because Israel, of course, has very real threats and very real existential threats, but I think that the issue of human rights versus security has also come up even in the last few years in the United States after 9/11 with the Patriot Act and people who are afraid that their human rights are being compromised if the government can, let's say, listen in on phone conversations. And I think in some cases people want to use security as an excuse to limit human rights.
I believe that you are completely right. And I think really the United States went overboard after the 9/11. They just didn't know where to push. And the risk is really that people or governments who are opposed to human rights, and let me tell you, no government is the best guardian of human rights and of freedoms, because it's easier to act in the government when you don't have them. So things went about. But let me tell you something interesting. There was the famous case against the Guantanamo, where the Americans expelled, they brought over a terrorist, so some people who were accused of terrorism, to Guantanamo, which was outside of the United States, in order to argue that they cannot enjoy the freedoms that apply to within the United States. There was two of the hostages there, or of the prisoners, petitioned to the Supreme Court of the United States, and I, together with another nine colleagues of mine, submitted an amicus curiae brief, which is people who want to get involved in the case and bring their opinion to the court. And actually, we brought to them the the situation in Israel as an example that you can both not neglect security and nevertheless not give up on human rights. And I think although the Supreme Court of the United States did not quote us because they don't like, there's a matter there of maybe ego or something, they don't quote foreigners. However, when I read their opinions, I can see our briefs very much lying there.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit about, you were here speaking about religious freedom in the Middle East, and you also have written about religious education in Israel. Can you tell us first a little bit about religious education in the public schools or private schools in Israel? How is that handled?
Okay, we have actually a diverse system where we have what we call state schools. The state schools are divided into general state schools and religious state schools. Next to them, we have recognized schools, which are schools that are not state schools, but they are recognized by the state as fulfilling the duty of providing education, which is compulsory in Israel till the class 3, class 12. Near them, we have a very unique Israeli phenomenon, which is exempt institutions. Exempt institutions are not recognized institutions. However, parents who send their kids to the exempt institutions are exempt from the duty of sending them to school, because parents who avoid sending their children to a school commit a crime and they can be prosecuted. Now, the division is state schools are fully owned by the states or by local authorities, and they are divided, as I said, into general and religious. The difference is in the emphasis on teaching religion. In the general schools, we teach as well texts, which we may regard as religious texts, like the Bible, and we teach about Jewish holidays. However, they are taught not from a religious point of view, but from a cultural point of view, because Judaism, and for this we will need a few hours, is not merely a religion, it's a nation, but on top of everything, it's a culture, in my view. In the religious state schools, they teach more religion. Recognized state schools are a reminder, or remains, of the system, the pre-statehood system. And they were schools that belonged to religious, I would say even religious parties, the United Religious Party in the Knesset, what we call Agudat Yisrael, and the Shas Party, the Oriental Religious Party. And they must teach a curriculum that is dictated, part of it is dictated by the states, and they get full support from the state. Other recognized schools are also under the duty to teach what we call the basic curriculum, which consists of English, mathematics, citizenship, and they get partial support from the state, supposedly depending upon the amount of basic curriculum they teach. However, when the Supreme Court was about to declare that the support for yeshivas, which are the academies of Judaism, should not get any support because they don't teach the curriculum, they regard it as a waste of time. A law was passed in the Knesset, which was called the Unique Cultural Institutions, and actually exempted them altogether from teaching a basic curriculum, and nevertheless, they're partially supported by the state. Now, alongside, we have the Arab state schools, where emphasis is, it's taught in Arabic, most of it, and the emphasis is on Muslim, Druze, or whatever culture or religion that the body of the students compose of. Along that, we have a good number of church schools. Chess schools are completely exempt from any inspection due to some historical background dating from pre-statehood. The irony is that most of the students, and sometimes all of the students in a church school, are Muslims, because they are not, they don't have that many Christians to cater for. And there were two cases where a Muslim girl refused to dress in a sport uniform for the sports and to take off the cover of her head. And the school exempted her, and the Supreme Court said if it happened in a state school, unlike, say, the La Cité in France, she would have the right to come however she would like to come dressed. But since it's a church school and it's against the culture of that church, the court did not intervene in that case. There was a similar case dealing with an Arabic professor, a woman who, by the way, was teaching Islam studies in that in the church, but she went to some bed vacation, came back, and was became more religious and was dressed, you know, with the hijab and whatever, and she was fired. The labor court, on the first instance, approved her firing. She appealed, and on appeal, they compromised. As far as I know, she got a nice amount of compensation from the church and didn't want to go on. The lawyer who represented her and was frustrated by the fact that she went into the compromise told me that if she went on, she would have won the case.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about this conference that you participated in recently in Madrid at the Casa Árabe, which was about religious freedom in the Middle East, and it spoke about Lebanese, Israeli, and Iraqi models?
Well, first of all, there was another model that was missing there, because if you read their publication, it's religious freedom in the Middle East, study of Lebanese, Palestinian, Israeli, and Iraqi models. Mm-hmm. The Palestinian didn't show up. I don't know why. This conference, or rather a project, was initiated by the Spanish Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I think by the Minister of Foreign Affairs himself, and was carried out by the Center of Studies of Middle East in Madrid. We had to submit comprehensive reports that were actually published, at least on the internet, by the organizers. And then we had a day or half a day where each of us told briefly what he wrote about, and then there was questions from the audience and from people who were designed to do it. We got very friendly with the head of that institute.
Did a lot of people attend?
It wasn't meant to be a huge conference. The participation was, I guess, by invitation only, and they invited people of that they thought should be interested in the issue. So I would say for an intimate conference, we had a nice turnout, actually more than they expected.
You had also spoken about religious freedom in Israel, just you, the day before at the Complutense University.
Yes.
Was that for students? Was that sort of open to the public?
It was a faculty seminar. And, yes, it was the day before, and it was a faculty seminar.
How was that received? I know that at that university, there have been problems, I guess, mostly with the students, that when Israelis have gone to speak or people have gone to speak about Israel, there have been boycotts, there have been demonstrations. Was there any of that when you were there?
No, it's something new what you tell me.
Oh.
No, I didn't experience anything. I had a very nice welcome. As a matter of fact, the only time that I've been, so to say, boycotted was when I was invited to speak about human rights in Judaism to an institute known as the El Mahdi Institute in Birmingham. When I visited their website, I was actually impressed by the fact that they invited me. It's a Muslim, I would say, radical institute. All the people before me were invited were Ayatollahs from Iran and so on. And they were very happy when I admitted their invitation. However, at some point very close to the conference itself, I was at the conference in South Africa, and I got an email from them apologizing that the board of that institute was very upset by the fact that an Israeli professor was invited to that institute, and they said no. And then there was also threats by the Muslim community in Birmingham that they are going to demonstrate, and then they, I would say, kindly as much as they could, asked me not to come. And a colleague of mine who was in South Africa with me, and he's writing also, he's a writer also in an Italian daily, wrote the other day an editorial saying, actually I wrote to them, if you think you can have a conference on freedoms within human rights in religion and do it without Judaism, good luck to you. And he quoted that as wrote an article about that. That was the only time that I experienced anything close to boycott. If I can remember, several years ago, I gave a talk at the Australian National University in Canberra in cooperation with the Israeli embassy. And when I came, I never saw so many policemen around, university police. They expected a demonstration, which never took place. This is my personal experience. I don't know if it's typical or not, but that's it. And I speak two cases, actually one case, out of dozens and more than dozens conferences that I participated in.
Well, we're kind of running out of time. Is there anything else you would like to add that we might have left out?
Maybe what I'll add, I arranged a conference at the Paris Institute several years ago. Called Peace, Brotherhood, and Human Dignity in the Monotheistic Religions. It was organized in cooperation with Prince Hassan, the brother of King Hussein from Jordan, who actually was supposed to be king, to be crowned after him, who is, one of the leading persons in the area of religious freedom and cooperation. And so he couldn't come, so he sent us over a video with a personal messenger. And the issue there was, and I think that's the issue of religion. I said, and then we made a declaration also to the fact that each religion is in favor of rights, freedoms, or at least peace, brotherhood, and what have you. Unfortunately, I think religion, and I said it also in Madrid, religion is supposed to be blamed for more bloodshed than almost any other ideology. And I think people of good faith from all faiths should try to somehow overcome that gap between what religions teach for and what they are responsible for. And then one more thing is that religion could not be overlooked. There were times, Soviet Union, whatever, that we thought that religion could be ignored. Religion is a strong power, and we should work with religion for the good and not against religion.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSephirah.com. See you next week.